It's from Wetumpka, Alabama, and I just love to say Wetumpka. But anyway, with that, I will give you Corey L.
Hi, my name is Corey Long, and I'm recovering one day at a time in the Worldwide Fellowship of the Al-Anon Alateen Family Groups. Hi. I am really nervous, and I'm nervous for a variety of reasons. The first is because I got to hear Tim speak last night. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. I'm looking forward to Mary, and the people I was sitting in front of yesterday were raving about Bill this evening. So I'm thinking, all right, I'm the only Al-Anon speaker, and apparently I'm the baby of the group as well. So that makes me just a little bit nervous. It's also, I have no idea what this talk is going to be because my life is fixing to change dramatically in the next 10 days, so I don't know what's going to come out today. But I do know that I've said my prayers, and by the time I'm done, hopefully you'll know why my life is going to change dramatically. I have a watch. If that makes anybody feel better, I probably won't use it, but I've got it. And I've got a notebook just in case I forget what I'm going to say, and that's never happened either, but it makes some people feel better. And if you finish, if you get tired of listening before I get tired of talking, that's fine too. I am supposed to share with you what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. And I know that God will show up here any minute. I have had a great time up here. Kent is with me. My husband is with me, and I've had a great time right up until this moment. And in about an hour, it'll be great again. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come and do this. It's always an honor and privilege to be able to share about Al-Anon, and it really is an honor to come to an AA conference because my theory is we got sick together. Isn't it nice celebrating getting well together? It's just a wonderful thing. So I am not an alcoholic. I am not an alcoholic at all, but I believe I've been affected, profoundly and deeply affected by the disease of alcoholism. So I thank you for your invitation to come and share. I thank Jerry for being in touch with me all year and calling and making sure I was on the way. And Boots has been just a fabulous hostess. If anybody's putting on a conference and wants to know how to do it, talk to them. They've done a great job. And so I thank you very much for making us feel so a part of. I am not originally from Wetumpka, Alabama, just in case you couldn't tell. I am originally Canadian. My mother is English. My father was Dutch. I spent most of my life growing up overseas, and I thought that was the reason I didn't fit in. That's the reason I felt different, was because of the way of my family. I had no idea it was the family disease of alcoholism until I got here. I got here on September 18th, 1998, which in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, will be 12 years if you're doing the math. I did not wake up and decide I wanted to live a spiritual way of life. It was not in my game plan to marry a man who was an alcoholic. I waited 36 years to marry him. He is my first and, God willing, my only marriage. And alcoholic was nowhere on the top 10 list of what I wanted in a husband. I mean, it just wasn't. And we got here on our two-month wedding anniversary. We'd been married 2 months when we checked him into treatment. I wasn't expecting that either. And it's, for me at least, Al-Anon's a really hard place to get to because they want you to ask for help. And it's really hard to ask for help when there's nothing wrong with you. At least it was for me. And there was nothing wrong with me that his not drinking wouldn't fix. And I didn't even want him to quit drinking completely. I just didn't want him to drink as much. So I had no idea about this disease called alcoholism. And when I got here and people said, you know, that you're as sick as him, I thought, no, I'm not. And when they said I needed to go to Al-Anon, I was a little offended because everybody kept implying that I had some sort of problem. Now, I'm glad that I stuck around long enough to realize I waited 36 years to marry the perfect man, and he was a raging alcoholic when I did it. That is not sane behavior. If you had asked me when I got here, did I know he was an alcoholic, I would have told you no. I would have said I thought he drank a lot. Only one time did I ever hear him slur his speech. I would have told you that he never missed a day of work. I was wrong about that. He told you he was a college graduate. Turns out I was wrong about that too. And I would have told you that an alcoholic was somebody who was homeless, that lived under a bridge, that drank out of a paper bottle, and besides, he only drank beer, so he couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, right? That's how little I knew about the disease of alcoholism when I got here. When we checked him into treatment on September 18th, 1998, That night, I got online and I found an Al-Anon meeting. And I'll tell you a little bit about how we got to that point. But I got online and I found an Al-Anon meeting, and somebody on that Al-Anon meeting said, find a meeting in person. Get to a meeting. And I'm so grateful for that, because I have the ability to isolate myself, and I have the ability to convince myself that I'm different, that I'm unique, that I don't have what you all have, so I don't need to do what you all did. And there was an Al-Anon meeting at that treatment center the next day. And I went to that meeting because I had to go to that. I thought, alcoholism is a funny disease. It affects my perception. And in my case, it affects my hearing. I don't always hear what is said. And I thought they said if I wanted to see him in the family time that Saturday afternoon that I had to go to the Al-Anon meeting. I don't think that's what they said, or the counselor may have said it to me, but they didn't generally say that. So I went to the Al-Anon meeting, and I walked into that Al-Anon meeting, and there were three little old ladies who I swear to God must have been 103. I was 35 years old. I'd been married 2 months, and what I heard them say was, oh, honey, he'll drink again. They all drink again. But have hope. What? What? And I burst into tears. I absolutely burst into tears, and I cried through that whole meeting, and I thought, I have no idea what I've done. I have no idea what I've gotten myself into. But the disease of alcoholism has said to me, you've made your bed, Missy. Now you will sleep in it. And I did not. It never once crossed my mind to leave them. I never knew it was an option. Because we'd married, and by God, we were in it till death. And I told him that at one point. I said, I will be a widow before I'm a divorcee. And he said, okay. And about 3 seconds later, he said, hey, that means I have to be dead. And I said, yes, it does. But you know what? That's funny now, but what that tells me a lot about myself is I would rather have my husband dead than to have you think I failed at a marriage. That's where the disease of alcoholism took me, and I don't even drink. I was the youngest of three children for 9 years. And I loved being the youngest of three children for 9 years. And I used to say that that's where my first resentment came, was when my little sister was born. And she may have been my first resentment, but she's not my first defect of character. My first defect of character is that feeling of not enough. I am not enough. And it was only this spring that I figure out, because I continue to do the work that I've done through the program, that I figure out where that came from. The disease manifests itself in my hearing. When I was born, my parents said to me, we thought you were going to be a boy, so we were going to name you Cornelis. He turned out to be a girl. We were going to name you Corey Patricia, after my father and after my mother. What I heard at that point was, we wanted a boy, and we get stuck with you. So we'll just make do with you. And that's and for almost four, I will be 48 years old this year, and for almost 47 years, I have operated under that premise, I am not enough because my parents wanted a boy and I turned out to be a girl. That has no bearing in reality whatsoever. My parents never said that. When I was born, they didn't do those baby tests to tell you what you were going to get. They'd had a boy, they had a girl, they thought I was going to be a boy. They played the odds. None of my family are good gamblers. I just turned out to be a girl. But I have operated under that basic premise, that core idea, that I was not enough. And I carried that all the way through into my marriage, into every relationship I was ever into, and into my marriage, and into Al-Anon. And I'm so very grateful for Al-Anon, because Al-Anon has not taught me how to change the past. What Al-Anon has taught me is how to change my perspective about the past. And I can change how I look at things. And I believe today that God can bring good out of any situation if I am willing to look for it. But I can also find bad in any situation if I'm willing to look for that too. And I want to look for the good today, because God has blessed me in so many, many ways. And He doesn't bless me because I'm Al-Anon. He blesses me because I'm me. And and I get to see it because I'm in Al-Anon. That's the only reason I get to see it, is because He tried to show me long before I got here, and I just couldn't see for whatever reason. So at 9.5 years old, my little sister was born, and I was convinced. My brain told me at that point, and there is no alcoholism in my family. I don't believe I grew up in alcoholism. I don't know if there's any way back where in my family tree, but there's no alcoholism in my immediate family. But my brain told me at the time my little sister was born was, see, you are not the daughter they wanted, so they had to have another one. You are not enough. You are not good enough. And that is what I've operated under. At 11 years old, my father took a job in Liberia, West Africa, and sent my older brother, my older sister, and I to a boarding school in Holland. And at that time, my friend told me yet again, see, they don't want you. They're tossing you off at boarding school. That is not true. I know today, and Al-Anon has allowed me to see what a great sacrifice that my parents made to be able to give us an education and send us away. And it must have just almost broke my mother's heart to send her three oldest children to a boarding school. And yet she did it. And I am so grateful today that Al-Anon allows me to see that, so I can be grateful to my parents for what they gave me and how they blessed me. That is not how I saw it at the time. I was 11 years old. I was the smallest kid on campus. I was the youngest kid on campus, and I was probably the geekiest kid on campus. I wore glasses then. The only reason I look good today is I have women friends in AA and Al-Anon who will go shopping with me. I do not do well with fashion. Just ask my husband. He'll show you some old pictures. It was not pretty. And I wondered why I couldn't get him. But so I'm at boarding school, and I'm in a room with five girls, four Dutch girls and me. They speak no English. I speak no Dutch. I learned Dutch much faster than I learned English. But I'm crying myself to sleep every night. And my older sister is there, and she is 18 months older than me, and she is thrilled to be in boarding school. She just thinks this is great. And she'd heard I was crying myself to sleep every night, so she came downstairs and she said, I hear you've been crying yourself to sleep every night. And I just knew. Another character defect of mine is mind reading. I'm not good at it, but it doesn't stop me. And I just knew what she was going to say was, it'll be okay, I'll take care of you, I'll be fine. And what she said to me instead was, you're embarrassing me. If you keep it up, I'll beat the crap out of you. Or at least that's what I heard her say. So I quit crying. That was the day I quit crying. That was the day I started stuffing my feelings. I'd be whatever you wanted me to be so I would fit in. I used to say I was athletic. Turns out I was just enthusiastic. I'm not really good at it, but I will give it the old college try. I am intelligent. I do well in school, and I like to read. And what reading did for me was it allowed me to escape. It allowed me to lose myself in these stories. But what it also did was it warped my brain enough that I had unrealistic expectations about anything and about everything. After about 2 years at the boarding school, my parents moved back to Dunwoody, Georgia, and I said I wanted to come home. And so I came home, and I wasn't home more than 3 months, and I was still miserable because while I was home, I was home, and there I was. And I was sure it was because I was a world traveler now, and the people in Dunwoody, Georgia did not appreciate my sophistication. And that's why I didn't fit in. And so when my father came home and said, we're moving to the Philippines, I said, great. I don't know where it is, but that's great. And so we moved in December of 1977 to Manila, the Philippines. And I really came into my own because my brother and my sister had stayed in Holland in boarding school, and my little sister was at the elementary school. I was at campus all by myself. Nobody knew any of them. It was just me. There's only one problem with that, is I didn't know me. I didn't know how to be me. I didn't know what I liked. I would do whatever you wanted me to be just so I would fit in. And I could fit in with anybody. And I don't know if this resonates with anybody here who might happen to be an alcoholic, because it certainly resonated with me. And I'm not an alcoholic. I believe that's the disease of alcoholism, that it's that internal spiritual malady. There is something in me that calls out and seeks out. And so I spent 2.5 years in the Philippines, and I was just having a grand time, and my father came home and said, we're moving to Singapore. And I said, no, I'm going to be a senior next year. We cannot move on my senior year. And he said, we're moving to Singapore. And I said, no, you don't understand. I'm going to be a senior. And he said, we're moving. And by God, we moved. And I came into this school in Singapore at the beginning of my senior year of high school, and I had a resentment, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I came to find out later that the reason why we had to move to Singapore was because the company my father was working for wanted him to launder money. And my father said, I have a family. I'm not willing to put them in that. I'm not willing to do that. He had integrity and he had ethics. And he said, I would rather leave this job and let you bring somebody else in than to do this. And that, I mean, my parents taught me things like integrity and character and hard work, ethics. I didn't see any of that until I got to Al-Anon. But that, I'm so proud of my father for being willing to do that. And that's something that I carry with me and I try and emulate today because my father's no longer with us. And so we moved to Singapore, and it's also the first opportunity I know that God – I can look back now and see God working in my life. I couldn't have seen it then because I had no idea. I only see one little piece of the picture. I do not see the whole picture. And when I got to Singapore, there was a guy in my high school class who was the king of the junior-senior prom. He was voted most sparkling personality. He was voted student body president, and he was voted Mr. Popular. Mr. Popularity, I think, is what it is. And that's the man sitting right back there in that room that I married 17 years later. He's the one in the yellow shirt who's beardless today, but that's another story, too. I did not know when I went to Singapore. I did not date Kent when the very first time I talked, I asked him if I could break his anonymity. I'm all about doing things right. I give me rules, I will follow them. And I heard somebody say, you can't break the alcoholic's anonymity. Oh. So I'm on my way to talk. He's in the car with me, and I panic. Can I break your anonymity? I don't think I can do this without saying your name. And he says, I'm not comfortable with you doing that. What? He said, just refer to me as SG. Now, his initials are KL. I have no idea what SG means. SG. SG, what do you mean, SG? And I said, what do you mean, SG? He said, you know, the spiritual giant that you live with. There is my spiritual giant. And he will instantly tell you the only reason he drank was so that I could find Al-Anon. He's a good guy. So I don't date Kent at all in high school. We are simply friends. He's dating somebody else. I'm kind of sort of dating somebody else. I don't really date. I don't know how to date, but I'm kind of trying it. But so we don't do any of this stuff, except the night we graduated from high school, June 10th, 1980. I remember every moment of that night. Every moment of that night, we ended up at a party at the Warren's house. We were at their apartment. We were standing in the bathroom looking at this bathtub full of beer that was filled with Budweiser beer. And Kent was there, and I was there. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he said, I don't want to be here. And I said, I don't want to be here either. And he said, well, let's go down to the Shangri-La Hotel. There was a band that played at the Shangri-La Hotel. And he said, let's go listen to Matthew and the Mandarins. So I said, great. I remember every moment of that evening. My husband, God loves him, does not remember a minute of it. Not an instant of it. And that's okay. That's the only night Kent and I ever went out and did anything together, and nothing happened. We just had a good time, and he went his way, and I went my way. I picked a college in Lewiston, Maine, because I thought it looked good in the brochure. I liked the pictures. I thought snow would be nice. I was an idiot. It was awful. Turns out, since I've been in Al-Anon, one of my assets, one of my talents is I'm resourceful. I did not know how to use my resourceful talents for good at that point, so I didn't use them at all, but I do know how to do it now. But so I'm at this college in Lewiston, Maine, and I met my first him. And I love it when you go to an AA or an Al-Anon meeting and you hear pronouns, him, her. You all know who we're talking about, them. You know, I met him, and I thought he was so sophisticated because he was a year older than me, and he drank vodka over the ice. I don't know what that's called. I screw it up every time. On the rocks. He's vodka on the rocks. And I thought, isn't that just sophisticated? And he did it every night, and I thought that was great for about the first 2 weeks. But like I say, I don't know how to date. If we go out, I'm in love. And we are going to trudge the road of happy destiny together, and I was sure this was the man for me. Now, I have come to realize that when I get as needy as I get in a relationship, because if I am not enough by myself, I have got to plug into somebody else. I have to find me a him, because I can't do it. I'm not enough myself. So I'm looking out there for him to make me feel okay about me. And once I've got him, I have got to hold on to him, because if I don't hold on to him, I may not find another him. Turns out there are always another him. I didn't realize I was going for Mr. I was looking for Mr. Right, but settling for Mr. Right Now. Whoever I had, I wanted. And so I kind of sort of latched onto this guy, and it didn't last very long. And then he broke up with me because when you're as needy as I am, you basically push people away. I push people away because it's just a lot of pressure to be in a relationship with me. And so he dumped me, and I again believed that it was me, that he just didn't want to be with me. Now, that's true. He didn't want to be with me, but it was because of all the defects that were coming out. But I thought that if I was anybody other than who I was, if I was taller, if I was shorter, if I was fatter, if I was skinnier, if I was blonder, if I was cuter, if I was funnier, if I was smarter, if I made more money, if I was somebody other than me, then people would like me. And that is the core idea that I operated under until I got to Al-Anon. I did what I now know as a geographic. I transferred from Bates College in Lewiston, Maine to Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and moved down here, and I told that guidance counselor the first day I was there what I wanted to do with my life, and she looked at me and she said, not with those grades, you won't. Because that's another thing I do, is once I get involved in your life, I am involved in your life. My life becomes secondary, I'm in yours. And my grades had just completely gone down the tubes because I was so focused on him, first getting him, then keeping him, and then getting him back again. That takes a lot of work, and classes get in the way of that. So I had a lot of work to do. If I wanted to do what I wanted to do with my life, I had a lot of work to do. And I did what I know to do. As I put my nose to that grindstone, I put my shoulder to the wheel, and I worked hard. And those are really good lessons to learn in life. Unless you're dealing with the disease of alcoholism, it does not work. Those do not work. Did not work well for me in the disease of alcoholism. So, I finished up at Emory University. I'd come in with really bad grades. I graduated with honors because I know what I need to do. You tell me what to do, and by God, I'll do it. I am a rules and regulations girl. I will follow the rules and get it done. I took a year off, and then I went to graduate school at the University of Georgia. Whew, I get to do that. Huh. I can do it here. So, I didn't date. I did not date at that point because I knew what I needed to do. I was single-minded and I was direct. I got out of school and I took a job in Montgomery, Alabama, and I was only going to be there for 2 years. And I laughed because when I told my mother that I was moving to Alabama, she said, "Oh my! I never expected any of my children to actually live in Alabama." Now, the really funny thing about that is my mother now lives directly across the street from me in Alabama, and my older brother lives in Madison, Alabama, so we're working on getting the other siblings a little closer to home. So I moved to Montgomery, Alabama. I was only going to be there for 2 years. 6 months before I was supposed to leave, I got offered another job, so I stayed for another year and a half, and 6 months before I left that job, I met another him. Now, I do not know if this guy was an alcoholic, but I know this. His drinking bothered me, and it bothered me a lot. When I met this guy, we were at a charity softball game. Now, I will tell you the reason I thought I had not been dating anybody up to that point in Alabama is because, again, I thought I was much too sophisticated for them. These, you know, rube Alabama boys just could not appreciate me. That's why I hadn't dated anybody. So I went to a charity softball game, and I met this guy. And this is what my brain tells me. Ooh, he's at a charity softball game. He must do good work. We started talking, and he told me that he had a job. Employed, that's great. He had a college degree. Wonderful. These were things that were important to me. I don't know why, but they were important to me. So there's an after-party, and we're talking at this party, and he asked for my phone number. I thought, what a gentleman. What a gentleman. I go home. He calls me at 10 o'clock that night, and he says, "The party is still going on here, and I have to get up tomorrow morning and go to work. Could I possibly sleep on your couch?" I thought, oh, and he's committed to employment, too. Oh, my God, what a good guy. All these things I'm looking for, of course you can sleep on my couch. And he did sleep on my couch that night. That was the only night he slept on my couch, and that was the beginning of a 2.5-year relationship with this guy. And I believe, for me, that is really where my alcoholism, my family disease of alcoholism kicked into high gear. I knew the guy drank beer. It's beer. You can't be an alcoholic if you drink beer, right? We instantly moved in together because he was in the midst of a divorce, and according to... I know. I look at it now and think, oh, my God, 7 years of a higher education, you are a moron. He was in the midst of a divorce. He... had no money because she had taken it all from him. I know. It's even hard to say at this point. You know, the reason he had financial difficulty was because he was paying her child support and she had to have all this stuff for the kid and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So he moved into my place, of course. I had the bank account. I had a job. I had furniture. It was great. He moves in and he's drinking because that's what he does is he drinks. And I'm thinking it's not that bad yet. It's not that bad yet. And then I decided that I should probably talk to him about his drinking because I'm getting concerned. He's drinking every night. I think, you know, we can have this reasonable, rational discussion about his drinking. Never occurs to me to not have the discussion while he's actually drinking. For some reason, I think I should talk to him while he's doing it. That's when the beer cans started flying, the doors started getting slammed. He never, ever hit me. But I can tell you, there's a lot of abuse that goes on that doesn't necessarily have to be physical. I mean, we had holes this big in the walls of our apartment from things that went flying. And I was terrified, absolutely terrified. But I didn't know what I was dealing with. So I do what I know to do. It's just try everything. Force a solution. One of the things I did that says a lot about me was I took a picture of his kid. His kid was 3 years old. Cutest little kid in the whole wide world. It was a great picture. I love to take pictures. I took this picture of this kid, and I blew it up. Now, I did not blow it up to 5x7 or 8x10. I blew this sucker up to 16x20, poster size, big. And I framed it, and I put it on the chair directly across, on the wall directly across from his drinking chair. And then I stood in front of it like I was Vanna White.
If you don't love me enough to quit drinking, perhaps you love your son enough to quit drinking.
You know there was beer cans flying that night, and I didn't understand it. I couldn't figure it out. I had no idea what we were doing. The only thing I know to do is I've got this guy and I've got to keep this guy. And one of the ways I know to do that is to give you things. My husband's really sad that Elon's changed that a lot. But so I gave this guy a credit card, and what he liked to do was he liked to buy weapons. I don't like weapons. He liked to buy weapons. And one night, this is a consistent theme, one night we were arguing about the drinking again, and he was drinking. And so he grabbed this sawed-off shotgun that he'd bought at a pawn shop that day and locked himself in the bathroom and said, "I'll just blow my brains out. That's what I'll do. That'll make you happy. I'll just blow my brains out." And I stood on one side of that door, and he stood on the other side of that door, and I argued with that guy for an hour and a half to please not kill himself. And I'd like to tell you it was because I was concerned about him. But the truth of the matter was I was concerned about me. What would you think of me if some guy would rather kill himself than be with me? Really. I mean, that's one thing. I've got to do everything I can. I have got to make this right. And that's where the disease of alcoholism takes me, and I don't even drink. That relationship ended. I know that comes as a huge surprise to everybody here. But he came home, he said he wanted me to buy the house next door to his parents, and I had enough sense to say no to that. And he said, "Well, if you love me, you'll buy me a house." And I said, "Can't do it. Not willing to buy you a house." So he took off that night, came home the next morning and said, "I need space and time." And I do not know where this came from except God. And I said, "Take all the space and time you want. This ship just sailed." And I packed my stuff up and I moved. I moved back to we were living in Birmingham. I was working in Montgomery. I moved back to the apartment that we still had in Montgomery, and I moved into that. Now, I did stalk him for a little bit, but that's just a defect of character of revenge and vengeance and that kind of stuff. I know that now. And apparently that is another defect. Vengefulness and revenge is a big character defect for me because when we broke up, I'm a lawyer. That's what I do. And I made this guy sign a legal binding contract that he would pay me back the money that I determined he owed me. And he would do it on a certain time period. And every month I made that man write me a check. And if he called me and said, "I can't afford to do it," I said, "Fine, I'll call your wife." Because he remarried about 8 months after we broke up. And, of course, yet again, another indication that I am not enough, that it's me. It wasn't that he didn't want to get married. He just didn't want to get married to me. And so I made him sign this document. I made that man pay me every month. And every time he called me and said, "I can't afford to pay," I said, "I'll call your wife." And he paid. I'm not proud of that, and I owe that man amends, but I can't find him. He's on my amends list, and I've been willing to do it since I got here. So when that relationship ended, I said, "That's it. I am never dating another man who drinks ever as long as I live." So the next guy I stalked happened to be a recovering alcoholic with 20 years in AA. And the reason I say I stalked him was because I wanted the relationship to be much more than it was, and I kept trying to force it, and he had enough sense to back away from the crazy woman. And I mean, I didn't understand it. This guy had 20 years in AA, and he'd say, we'd go out to dinner. I'd say, "Well, just have a glass of wine." He'd say, "I don't drink." "Well, it's just wine." I did not get it, and I am a smart girl. I did not get it. In 1996, I got a computer, and I put this little message on the high school bulletin board that said, if you were the class of 1980, email me. This is in November of 96. On February 1st, 1997, I got an email from Kent saying, "Hey." Now, this is part of his story, and he lets me tell it because I just think it's God working in our lives. I believe God wants us to be together. Kent got a computer for the very first time on February 1st, 1997. He went to work, and he said, "What's a search engine?" They said, "Just pull any of them, AOL or whatever, and type in any word you want, and it'll pull up all these things." He typed in Singapore. I did not know until he got sober that was the last time he felt good about where he was in life. So he typed in Singapore. 5,000 hits come up. He scrolls down and sees Singapore American School. Wow. Clicks on that. We have an electronic bulletin board. He scrolls down, finds class of 1980. There is one message on the 1980 bulletin board. That would be mine. Thank you. He emails me. I email him back. He emails me, says he's going to work. I say, "Screw this, call me." And I type my phone number in. The problem is he has no idea where I am. He has no idea if I'm married. He has no idea what my last name is. And I type the phone number in incorrectly because I just had surgery on my wrist. All right? That night when he gets home from work, he apparently types phone numbers into the phone for about an hour and a half until he gets me. He gets me at 9 o'clock at night on February 1st, 1997. The first phone call was 11 and a half hours long. Yeah, I know. Yeah. We just did it. Basically, I think I did this and he just kind of listened. And I said at some point in the course of this conversation, "I want a man who doesn't drink." And he says, "I don't drink much." good enough for me. I said, good enough for government work. I said, how much is much? And he says, 3 or 4 beers a week. That's not really drinking. We all know that's not really drinking. Great. What that says about me is how quickly I'm willing to move that boundary for him. And it went, man. That's great. And so we started this long day. I hung that phone up after 11 and a half hours. I came to find out later when he got sober, the first time he spoke at a year, at the home group he got sober at, on your 1 year anniversary, you spoke for the first time. And during that phone conversation, that man had 18 beers. I did not know that. And I was like, 18 beers? He's like, hell, that's controlled drinking. I'm like, oh. See, I don't get that aspect of it, but I get the family disease of alcoholism aspect of it. I hung that phone up, called my girlfriend at the time. I said, this is the man I'm going to marry. And she's like, all right, whatever. And we started dating. He was working for an airlines in D.C., so he could fly down to Montgomery for $20 each way. Now, if that's not God's working in our lives, I don't know who he is. And I like to tell people we had to get married because we couldn't afford to date, because the first phone bills between the two of us in that first 28 days that we – and isn't it ironic? It was 28 days before the first phone call when I actually saw him, when I picked him up at the Atlanta airport, our first phone bills were over $1,000. Yeah, so we had to get married. We couldn't afford to date. My father called me. My little sister got married in 96, and they went through this whole rigmarole about picking a date, not having a date, canceling a wedding, replanning the wedding, the whole bit. So my dad calls me in July and says, pick a date. I'm not going through with you what I went through with your little sister. Pick a date. And I picked my parents' 40th wedding anniversary, which would have been March of 1998. And he said, great. Hung the phone up, and I called Kent. And I said, how do you feel about getting married? On March 28th, 1998. And he said, okay. You know, made perfect sense, right? He did not ask. We had not talked about it. He calls back about 15 minutes later and says, you think I ought to get divorced first? Yes, I think that would be a good idea. Now, the man had been separated for a few years. I had no clue what was going on, but I am resourceful. I am hardworking, I am industrious, and I am bright. So I started planning a wedding on one hand and planning a divorce on the other hand, because I can do that. A normal person would have waited on the wedding until the divorce was final. Not me. I had him. I was keeping him. So we start planning this wedding. I start planning this wedding. I start planning this divorce. We have no idea where the soon-to-be ex-wife is. Again, God working in our lives. She calls him in December and says, I need money. And Kent says, well, hold on, she needs money. I said, tell her she can have it. We'll pay her if she signs the papers. And tell her she has to pick it up at the lawyer's office. And so she agreed. And so we sent a check to the lawyer's office. She showed up. She signed those papers. We got them filed. I always like to say, my father ended up in August of that year. We got engaged in July. In August of that year, my father was diagnosed with brain cancer. On August 25th, 1997, he was diagnosed with brain cancer, and he passed away on September 25th, 1997. And it's the last time I vividly remember praying, please, God, let my father live. Please, God, just let my father live. And my father died, and I took that as an information from God that I was not worthy of him listening to my prayers. I'm so grateful that Al-Anon has allowed me to look at that situation different. I know today that if my father had lived, he'd have been incapacitated. And my mother would have killed herself trying to take care of him. And it was God saying, not, honey, you're not worthy. Saying, you don't see the big picture. You don't understand. My father had one headache the entire time he was sick. When he died, his brother from Holland was by his side, my mother was by his side, and Kent and I were on the way to the airport to pick up my sister. That's a God thing. That's a God thing. And I know that today, and I'm so grateful that Al-Anon lets me look at that situation differently. I can't change it, but I can certainly look at how I view it, because for the longest time, I was mad at God, and I hated God, and God could be over here, and I would be over here. And when I saw that third step, turn my will and my life over the care of God, I don't think so. I don't think so. He's not done so well so far. I'm not doing that. So Al-Anon's allowed me to change the way I look at that, and that is a great, great thing. So we ended up pushing the wedding back to July, because even I knew we couldn't get married on my parents' 40th wedding anniversary after he had just passed away. But I do like to say, his divorce was final in Virginia on February 18th. You have to wait 30 days in Alabama. He could have gotten married on March 18th. I had him divorced within 10 days of our wedding date. So he could have gotten married on that first wedding date, because I am very good. And we didn't tell anybody what was going on. We did not tell anybody. I'm just planning a wedding like everything is going to be fine. Did not tell anybody. You know, he may not actually be divorced. We may have to push this thing back. I was just... My will, by God, we're pushing this through. One of the things my father did before he passed away was he actually made Kent promise to invite his parents to the wedding. Kent had told me that he was estranged from his parents. I had no idea why, and I didn't think to ask why. He's a grown man. I just thought, okay, his parents must be nuts. And my father said, family's important. Promise me you'll invite your parents to the wedding. And so, you know, my husband, even when he was drinking, did not want to break that promise to a dying man. And so after my father died, we invited his parents to the wedding. And we got married in July. We ended up going to Ireland for our honeymoon, which is a wonderful place to take an active alcoholic. We want to go back when he's not drinking. The one thing I remember, many things I remember about my honeymoon, but one of the things I remember is my husband offered the bar drunk beer if he would just dance with me one night. And so we couldn't get the guy to stop dancing with me. I mean, he was like, beer, yes. I mean, I know he's the bar drunk because he woke up out of the booth. He'd been passed out in the booth. He woke up, Kent said, I'll buy you a beer if you dance with her. Okay. Couldn't get him to stop. It was awful. But took him to Ireland, and 2 months later, we went to Callaway Gardens on a Saturday, and I knew there was something horribly wrong with my husband. He was restless, he was irritable, and he was discontent. But I couldn't have told you what that was. I would have just told you he was a complete and total idiot. And he was shaken, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning. And I did not know what that was, but I knew it was not good. And I'd been married 2 months. And we came home, and I said to him, you know, if we need to stop and buy you beer for the way home, and he just snapped, I don't need beer. I'm like, all right, back away from the crazy man. When we came back to Montgomery, it's an hour and a half drive, and we did not speak. And I don't think we spoke that entire day. And about 4 days later, it was a Thursday evening, I had to go to a professional meeting, and we got in an argument about something. I don't know what we got in the argument about, and I stormed out of the house, and he stayed in the house, and I went to this meeting, and as I was coming home, the thought came to me, you need to go to Al-Anon. I have no idea where that came from. Didn't even know what Al-Anon was. Had no idea about AA. Don't think I'd ever heard anybody mention AA or Alcoholics Anonymous. I came home. I got in the bed. And Kent says to me at 10 o'clock that night, I don't think I can quit drinking without help. All right, what do we need to do? I think I need to go to treatment. Great, we have a plan. I can do this. Give me something to do. We can do this. So we took him to treatment the next day, September 18th, 1998. And to the best of my knowledge, and I'm pretty confident in saying this, my husband has not had a drink since that day. And our lives changed on that day. I did not know that that was going to be the beginning of a spiritual journey for me. If I had known it, I probably would have run screaming from the treatment center. There was a family counselor there who said, if you love him, you will go to Al-Anon. And I thought, of course I love him. I just married him, for God's sakes. And I was offended. I was absolutely offended that she would think I did not love him enough to go to Al-Anon. That woman, who was a family counselor at that meeting, goes to my home group today, has been a member of good standing in Al-Anon for almost 30 years, and she's what I call my local sponsor. I'm accountable to seeing her at meetings today. I have a long-distance sponsor. So I thought, all right, fine, I'll go to Al-Anon. And I'd go, and you guys would say things, you know, like, one day at a time. I am a forward planner. I am a forward thinker. I plan in advance. I am not doing anything one day at a time. I mean, I need to know what's happening. And they'd say, keep it simple. Do you know what I live with? I can't keep it simple. I've got all this stuff I'm managing. Yeah, that first step was quite the doozy for me. You're powerless over alcohol. I have no problems with alcohol whatsoever. Your life is unmanageable. I am the only one managing my life, and if you'd look around, you'd see that. So I had a really hard time with this. I had a really hard time with the steps. But I start going to Al-Anon meetings. I start going to Al-Anon meetings, and Kent starts going to AA meetings. And one of the things this family counsel do, I don't know if she had my number or what, but every meeting, every family group we would go to, because I do what I'm told to do. You go here, you show up here, you do what you're supposed to. Every meeting I'd go to, she'd say, did you go to Al-Anon this week? And I'd say yes, and she'd make a little note. And she'd say, what'd you learn? And I'd tell her what I'd learned. She'd make a little note. And I'd heard somewhere along the process that if you completed 8 weeks of family, you got a certificate. And I thought to myself, this is the extra credit. She's not telling anybody. This is the extra credit, and I have figured it out. I am going to be the number one graduate of family counseling. And so that is why I kept going to Al-Anon meetings. I am not proud of that. It's a God using a defect of character, competitiveness. I can do this. I can win. I started going to Al-Anon meetings. 4 days into my husband's treatment, he came home to me and he said, I need to be rigorously honest with you. And I said, okay. He said, I am not a college graduate. I quit school, and I was a junior in college. All right? I did not voluntarily leave the Army. They asked me to leave for alcohol abuse and for treatment failure. Okay. I do not have $25,000 in a credit union in the bank in Northern Virginia as an early out from the Army. And this is not my first treatment center, it's my third. 4 days. Okay. It never crossed my mind to leave. It never occurred to me to leave. It never occurred to me. It was just like, all right, what do I do with this? And he said, I'm going to bed. He will tell you, he slept like a baby that night. I cried the entire night. I was like, I don't know what to do with this information. What do I do with this information? And I went back to the family council, and she said, keep going to Al-Anon. Just keep going to Al-Anon. That was, he came on a Tuesday, and on Wednesday, he called me from treatment. He says, I have to go to an AA meeting tonight. I'm like, you're still in treatment. I got to go. All right. And apparently the next day he'd gone and told his counselor that this was not his first treatment center. It was his third. And they said, what do you think we can do for you that you haven't already had done? And they sent him to a place called North California Street in Montgomery. It's AA. It's hardcore AA. Lots of old-timers in that meeting. And he got there and he got a sponsor. And his sponsor said, you will be here at an hour before the meeting at 7 o'clock. You will stay an hour after the meeting until 10 o'clock, and you will come to a meeting. He said, I'm willing to do 90 and 90. And he said, good for you, Skippy. Are you willing to go to a meeting a day for a year? And he said, okay. And he came home, and he said, I got to go to a meeting a day for a year. And I said, well, what am I going to do? I mean, I've been married for 2 months. What am I going to do? Hello? And he said, well, I think AA and Al-Anon are the same programs. Why don't you just do what I do? I'll tell you what I'm doing, and you just do the same thing. Yeah, that started the next year of my husband sponsoring me in Al-Anon, and if anybody is thinking about that, I can just tell you my experience was that was the hardest year of our marriage. It really was the hardest year of our marriage for a variety of reasons. About 2 months after that, we went to our first conference. The very first Al-Anon speaker I ever heard was Mary Pearl, and the very first and the very first AA speaker I ever heard was Clancy, and I was horrified. Absolutely horrified. Mary Pearl talked about drowning her husband in the bathtub, and I thought, I didn't know homicide was an option, and I cannot believe you're telling people that. And then Clancy talked about going to mental institutions, and Tim last night talking about penitentiaries. We don't talk about stuff like that. Oh, my God. And they were saying it from the front of a room with a room full of people like this. But I'll tell you what it did. It got me hooked. It absolutely got me hooked because what I was able to do was say, if they could do something for that man up there, who is so much worse than my husband, perhaps they can do something for him too. And I'll tell you, we used to go to the first year he was sober and the first year I was in Al-Anon, every Saturday night was our date night. We'd go to dinner and we'd go hear an open AA speaker at his home group every Saturday night. And that turned out to be a blessing in more ways than one, is because that is where I heard about the family disease of alcoholism. That's where I could start believing people that my husband was not just being a jerk. Because everything he told me up to that point had been lies. And so I couldn't believe him when he would say things to me about, it's a disease, it's not like I want to get up and drink. Thinking, why not? I mean, I don't know why you can't not drink. But when I heard other people talk about alcoholism as a disease, I could believe you guys, because you had no reason to lie to me. I could listen to people in AA talk about what the family did, what alcoholism had done to you and the things that you had done in your families, and that you could get better if you did what they suggested in AA. So when Kent would come home and say, I have to go and do this, this is what they've told me in AA to do, I say, okay, because you all were willing to share your experience, strength, and hope with us. And I am so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I would not have the husband that I have today without you. I would not have an Al-Anon program without Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is where I'm going to get on my little book, my little stump, just a little bit. I believe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our fifth tradition, the Al-Anon fifth tradition, says we should learn all we can learn about alcoholism, and we practice the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous ourselves. I do not know any better place to learn about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous ourselves than the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I believe in that big book, and I use that big book. I don't use it in meetings because I believe in our traditions as well, that they don't want us to use it. It's non-conference approved literature. Fine, but I use it with the women and the men that I sponsor, and we go through that big book. We go through the Al-Anon literature, and we go through the big book, because I see myself on those pages, because I have the family disease of alcoholism. The only thing that is different about me and my husband is I don't have the allergy to alcohol. Alcohol does not do for me what it does for him, but I'll tell you what does for me, what does for him, people, particularly men. An alcoholic will do for me what alcohol will do for him every time. Every time. And that is why the family disease, I have the family disease of alcoholism. That's why the 12 steps of AA and of Al-Anon work for me. And that is why I'm not the same woman today that I was when I walked in the rooms almost 12 years ago. Because the steps have changed me. They have transformed me. What I have done in the program of Al-Anon has changed me. I was new. Kent was sponsoring me. We had about a year. And one of the things that happened when Kent got sober was he suddenly developed opinions. And he developed opinions about how to spend what I considered to that point to be my money. I mean, I had been managing it. I'd been the one taking care of it. He hadn't been bringing near as much into it as I had been bringing into it. So it was my money. And he suddenly had opinions. And that was not easy for me. What we wanted, where we wanted to go for vacation, what did he want to do? Before, when he was drinking, he was like, whatever. I mean, he couldn't focus beyond the next drink. If I said there'd be beer, he'd be okay. But now he had ideas about where he wanted to go and what he wanted to do and what he wanted to spend our money on. And it was a hard year. It was a really hard year. And I'd ask somebody to be my sponsor, but because there was nothing wrong with me, I was just going to get the sponsor, but nobody said I had to do anything with the sponsor. And so I never called her. And I tell you today, I know that there's a difference between having a sponsor, using a sponsor, and allowing myself to be sponsored. And I choose today to allow myself to be sponsored. And after about a year, Kent had started running. He'd taken up running. And, of course, you know, I'm helpful. I like to help. I said, would it help you if I rode a bike next to you? And he said, yes, that would be great. And so every time he'd run, I'd ride beside me because I'm helpful. And he would yabber in my ear, you know, what step are you in? Have you gotten a sponsor? What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. How many times you call it? Blah, 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 blah. And one Sunday morning, there was this woman who'd moved from Oklahoma to our home group. And the very first meeting she was at, I remember. Remember, it's a disease of my hearing is affected. And she's at this meeting, 20 years in Al-Anon, and we're talking about the 12th step. And I said, I haven't worked the 12 steps yet, but I carry the message. And what I heard her say to me was, honey, you are not carrying the message. You are spreading the disease. Shut up. I know today that she did not say shut up, but she said everything else. And I just went home in tears. Oh, she hurt my feelings. And Kent horned right in on that. And if you asked her to be your sponsor, you should ask her to be your sponsor. I think she'd be a good sponsor. And so he's just in my ear, in my ear, in my ear. And so one Sunday morning, we're out running, and he's, yeah. And I just looked at him, I turned around, and I took that bike, and I raced home, and I called this woman on the phone. I said, would you be my sponsor? And she said, well, why me? And I said, because I'm going to kill him. I'm going to run him over with the truck. And she said, no, honey, why me to be your sponsor? And I said, because I think I want what you have. You just seem to be happy. You seem to be peaceful with whatever's going on in your life, and you work the steps, and you know about the steps, and you've got literature, and I always like what you say. And she said a very valuable thing to me. She said, are you willing to do what I did to get it? And I said, yes. And she said, all right, then we'll start working on the steps. And I started doing the steps with her. She was only supposed to be in Montgomery for a year. Her husband got extended for a second year, and I believe, again, God working in my life, I was not through the steps. And he knew that I needed to get through the steps before he moved LaWanna on. And so we went through that steps, and I started doing service work. She started telling me to go to area meetings, go to district meetings, go to speaker meetings, which we were still doing, and I got involved. And anywhere she said, were you going to do this? I went with her. Get in the car. I got in the car. And we went and we did, and I worked those steps, and I worked them to the best of my ability. And at the end of that second year, her husband was in the military, and they ended up moving. And she said, you need to get a local sponsor. And so I asked the woman who is now retired from the treatment center, who was a regular member of Al-Anon, if she'd be my local sponsor, if she'd be my sponsor. And she said, yes. And I was not comfortable. I don't know what it was. I just couldn't do it. And after about 4 months of trying to make this work, I called LaWanna and I said, I have tried so hard to make this work. I can't do it. Will you please still sponsor me? I will do whatever you tell me to do. Please still sponsor me. And she said, all right. And she has been my sponsor ever since. She's been my sponsor since I first came in and ever since. Because I was still calling her during those 4 months. I was still had the local sponsor. She said, keep the local sponsor so you're accountable to her at meetings. So you have somebody you have to see at meetings. And I said, fine. And I presently attend three meetings a week on a regular basis. I go to the Monday night fellowship group. We meet Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday at 6 o'clock in Montgomery, Alabama. And I go to a 6:30 a.m. First Things First group on Tuesdays and Thursday mornings. Three meetings a week works really good for me. I sponsor a lot of people, and about 7 years ago, I swore I would never sponsor another man again as long as I lived. And about 2 years ago, a fellow came to the program, and I just knew I could just tell it. I just knew. And I started praying. I was talking to my sponsor and praying and talking to my sponsor. And when that man asked me to sponsor him. I said I was willing to sponsor him if he was willing to have me sponsor him. And we've been working together, too. So I've got people that I sponsor that I'm taking through the steps, I'm taking through the literature, and it's a miracle. About 2 years into the program, Kent decided that he thought he could be fiscally responsible, and he thought he needed to learn how to be fiscally responsible, so he got a credit card. And he got that credit card, and he maxed that credit card out really quickly. It was a very low limit, and I got the first bill, and I said, I cannot believe you have charged $386 on this credit card in a month. He said, that's got to be wrong. That can't possibly be right. And I said, here you go. And he's looking at it. I said, man, these things really add up. Yes, they do. And so he said, all right, I'll give up the credit card. So I gave up the credit card for a couple of years. And I was looking back. I keep this journal that I do a list every year and in December of what I'm thinking about for the next upcoming year. And in 2004, my husband came to me and said, they are asking for civilians to volunteer to deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan, and I want to do it. And I thought, no. No, I said, well, I had enough program to say, let me pray about that. Let me talk to my sponsor about that. So I prayed about it and talked to my sponsor about it. And my sponsor is just, her husband's in the military. Is that not a God thing? And she said, you practice traditions in your marriage? And I said, I do. She said, what's the fifth tradition say? I said, the fifth tradition says I support and encourage my alcoholic. And she said, then how do you possibly think you can say no to that? I said, well, I guess, when you put it that way, I don't guess I can. And so I said, if this is something that you want to do, go ahead. And he started applying in November 2004 for this. But we've got this whole credit card thing going on here, right? And a couple of years later, he says, okay, now I think I can be fiscally responsible. I want to get a credit card. So I said, all right, fine, get a credit card. So he got a credit card, and this one had a $2,000 limit. He rapidly reached that, and I said, that's it, I'm done. We're not doing this anymore. Figure out something. I'm not continuing to pay this stuff off. You got to figure out what we're going to do. So we came up with the idea that he'd have his own separate bank account, and that would be fine. We'd put this money in a bank account, and however he chose to spend that money, that was his deal. It was not my deal. And he said that was fine. So we started doing that. While all this is going on, I was out in private practice, and my boss came. The guy that hired me the very first time I moved to Alabama came to me and said, I heard you might not be happy where you're at. Would you be willing to come back and work for me? And I said, yes. He said, it will be less money, and you will not get a car. I had a company car, and it would be less money. And I have a huge fear of financial insecurity, had a huge fear of financial insecurity. And I said, let me pray about that. I prayed about it, talked to Kent about it. Kent said, you're miserable at your job, and you're bringing it home, making me miserable at your job. So who cares about the money? So I said, okay, fine. So I took this other job that was less paying, didn't have a car. We had to buy a car and all this stuff, and I'm just freaking out about the money. And after about 5 months of it all being okay, I mean, I'd gotten calmed down. Everything was okay. My boss came to me and said, hey, guess what I found out? I can pay you more money. What? And I suddenly got this huge pay raise that he didn't know he'd give me. But I had to go through that. I had to be willing to do it. I had to be willing to not worry but not know how it was going to come out. So I'm working for this guy who I absolutely adore, and his wife has been diagnosed with breast cancer. And I have an opportunity to apply for my dream job. It is the job of my dreams. I've always wanted it. Still did not think I was good enough, didn't think I could do it, and wasn't willing to apply for it. And I'd done enough work here with my sponsor, and she said, you've at least got to apply. Your job is to walk in the direction of your dreams. Where you end up is up to God. Just apply. And I talked to Ken about it. He said, you got to apply. How can you not apply? And I said, I don't think I can do it. He said, if you get the job, God will make sure you can do it. It'll be okay. So I applied for this job. I applied for the job. We went off on a trip. I got notified while I was on this trip overseas that I had been selected for an interview. They'd weeded the packed down from 200 people to 10, and I was in that 10, and I was freaking out. And I came back, and I did the interview, and I found out that I did not get the job. They hired two, and I was the third on the list, and I didn't get it. And the cool thing about that is I was okay with it, because all I said was, please, God, let your will be done. Whatever your will is, your will be done. It's okay, whatever it is. And I was okay with that. I had people come down and say, you should be angry about this. And I said, I just asked for God's will to be done. This is great. The next week, my boss's wife took a turn for the worst and became terminal. And I knew at that very moment the reason I didn't get that job was because God needed me to be there for him so that he could be with her. I say the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer every morning. And I believe I ask God to help me to be of maximum use to him and my fellows. And that was how I got to be of use to my boss and to his family, is I could be in the office so he could be with his wife when she passed away 5 months later. I have never had any regrets about that job. It was perfectly fine. Everything was great. As a result of this fear of financial insecurity, I've had a 3-year financial plan, which would have worked if we had not spent a dime on anything. And I mean anything. Anything. But around the same time as this all happened, in October of 2008, I was this close to my financial plan being realized, that I was finally going to be debt-free. And Kent came to me, and he said, "We need to talk." Those have got to be two of the worst, you know, the worst, one of the worst things you could ever say to your wife: "We need to talk." Oh, I hate it when he does that. So we sat down, and he says, "I have gotten us into some financial difficulty." I'm thinking, us, Kimi Masabi? And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I've been getting credit card offers in the mail. My credit's repaired itself, and I've been getting them. And I have been taking advantage of them." And I said, "Okay, how much do you owe?" And he didn't really know how much he owed until we sat down, we figured it out. And he'd gotten us into $42,000 worth of credit card debt in about 3 years. And I will tell you, this is God working in both of our lives, because I said to him, "It's only money. We'll work it out." I think he probably almost fell off the couch, because, like, who is this woman? What have you done with my wife? And I really meant it. It was only money. We'd work it out. We'd figure it out. It'd be okay. And they started doing what we needed to do. And we went off to a conference in January, and we came back. You know, you come back, you're just oozing with serenity. The program is just coming out of every pore, and you're just full of the program. And I got the mail, and he'd bought $34 symphony tickets for us to go to the symphony. And I melted down. I just had an absolute, total, and complete meltdown, and just was a crazy woman about, you're spending money and blah. It was awful. It was absolutely awful. In November 2007, I had taken up running to lose some weight, and the only thing I needed to do at this point was to go run, because I couldn't talk to him. So I'm out running. I'm thinking, and I'm praying, "Please, God, you've got to give me some guidance and direction. I don't know what to do in this situation." And I vividly heard somebody say to me, "You got to make a decision. Either you're in the marriage or you're not. It's either your debt together or you're out of the marriage." And I thought, I'm not out of this marriage. I'm in the marriage. All right. So I went back and said, "We'll work it out." And, you know, that's the last time I've worried about that. We just continue to do what we do. We continue to pay it off. We're very close again to having it paid off at the end of the year. And we continued over the course of the years to apply for these deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. And in June, we'd gone out to dinner with my mother. He'd had an application into Iraq for months, 3 or 4 months. And they called him on a Thursday morning and said, "You didn't get the job in Iraq." And I was like, "Yes." And I was like, "Oh, that's so sorry, honey." And he said, "But they asked me to apply for this job in Djibouti, Africa." He said, "But they need a security clearance." So he's got a security clearance. He said, "But they need a top secret. They won't. I won't get it." And so he called the woman, and said, "I don't have this clearance." And I said, "We're sending your application anyway." This was on Thursday. They wrote him a letter on Friday. He got on Monday and says, "You're going to Djibouti, Africa." He called me. He said, "I'm going to Africa." I'm like, "You're what?" He said, "I'm going to Africa, and I'm going to Africa for a year." I'm like, "All right." And so we've been waiting, going through all the process, the paperwork, everything that needs to be done for him to go. When I had the conference to go to last week, he calls me on Monday of this week and says, "I got to be there by the 31st of August. I'm like, "What?" I thought I'd get 30 days notice. I got 2 weeks notice. And he may leave next Friday. We don't know. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, my God. But because of the program of Al-Anon, because I have done the work, because I have continued to do the work that I have done of working the steps, working with my sponsor, doing the service work, taking people through the steps, I know with every fiber of my being that this is something that God wants for Kent to do. I don't know why that is, but it's something that he has to do. And I'm okay with that. People have said to me, "You're letting him do this?" Like, he's a grown man. We talked about it. We prayed about it. If this is something he needs to do, I am going to support and encourage my husband. And I'm going to put him on a plane and send him to Djibouti. Now, I will tell you, in the course of all of this, isn't it great to say Djibouti? We've all been having a laugh about that. But in the course of all of this, as I do all of this, as I sit back and I watch him go through this, and I know that this is an adventure for him, I'm a little scared. I'm going to be by myself for a year. He is off having this adventure. I can see it in his eyes that he is already there. And that's okay. When they called us on Monday and said he's got to be there by the 31st of August, I said, "Well, I'm a little shocked by that." He said, "I'm ecstatic." And thank God for the program for Al-Anon that I didn't take that personal. And I didn't think, what do you mean? You want to get out of here? You want to get rid of me? What's going on? I didn't think those thoughts because it's so exciting to watch him to be able to do this. But the only reason he can do any of this stuff is because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Al-Anon. Since my husband got sober, he went back to school and got his undergraduate degree. He also went back to school and got his master's degree. He got a job that he absolutely hated, but his sponsor said he couldn't quit. And so he said, I need more training. What do I do? And I said, is there training out there? He said, yeah. I said, we'll pay for it. We'll do whatever we need to do. All of those things that he has done over the past 10, 12 years have put him in the exact position for him to be the person they want to go to Africa to help set up a joint task force command over there. How cool is that? This is the man that couldn't hold a job when we got married. He was working at a fish farm, for God's sakes. That's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the power of Al-Anon is I'm okay loving him enough to let him go do what he needs to do. God has been so good to us. He has blessed us with so much. He doesn't give us any of this stuff because we're in AA or in Al-Anon. I think I get to see all that he's given me because I am in Al-Anon. I have people in my life that are going to be doing all sorts of service work. They just don't know it yet because I'll have plenty of time on my hands over the next year. I got sponsees who said, we'll get in the car, go with you wherever you want to go. I've got people who say, you want to go run? I'll go run with you. I am surrounded with people who love and care about me and who love and care about Kent, who are going to send him off on his adventure with prayer and who are going to surround me with that love that I won't have while he's gone. And I thank you all for that, because if it were not for AA and it were not for Al-Anon, we wouldn't have anybody in our lives. Everybody in our lives and everything that's good in our lives is a direct result of what you have taught us on how to live our lives based on these spiritual principles embodied in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you, AA, for letting Al-Anon use them and for changing my life. Thank you.